Planning Matters is a podcast examining relevant issues and topics of city planning and why they matter for the cities we love. Each episode, we will explore a particular issue confronting cities that's relevant to city planning. While the views expressed in each episode are that of my own, know that each episode is based on careful research and professional experience. In the show notes, I will provide relevant links to my resources to learn more about what is discussed in each episode. That's it for housekeeping. Now, on to the show. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Planning Matters. Again, I'm your host, Alex Huffman. Today's episode, Designing Profitable Neighborhoods, is an expansion of the last episode that looked at how the fundamental building block of cities is the city block. In today's discussion, what we'll look at is how building profitable neighborhoods became the paramount decision-making process in how neighborhoods are ultimately designed in the modern city. So as a quick refresher to last episode, what we looked at is how initially the design of cities was based on the gridiron plan or the city block. And we talked about how in different cities, the dimensions can vary, but the important thing is that the consistency of the grid allowed for outward expansion of cities. But what we saw is that over time, the grid and the gridiron plan became less important. And as a result, many of our cities today are very disconnected, lack that connectivity. You become very easily disoriented. Again, what Kevin Lynch in his book, Image of the City, referred to as being a legible city, that is, when you're easily able to navigate and orient yourself in a city, that particular area is very legible. Many neighborhoods today are not very legible in that the streets tend to be very curvilinear. They have cul-de-sacs. They may dead end. And otherwise, you can't get from neighborhood to neighborhood without going out to a main street, like an arterial street, and leaving that neighborhood completely and entering again in again. And this is very much intentional. This is by design. And that's really what we want to discuss today is how do we change from building, from a design perspective, good neighborhoods to this idea of building profitable neighborhoods. And this is a really interesting discussion because it actually dovetails into a discussion of how mortgages became, you know, very important and synonymous in American culture. But for today, we really want to focus on the design perspectives and the implications that building profitable neighborhoods has on good city design. So again, the name of today's episode is Designing Profitable Neighborhoods. And the title of this episode actually comes from a bulletin, which is essentially just a short book that the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, who of course are the major source of our mortgages today, put out decades ago. I say decades because I'm not exactly sure. The book doesn't have a date on it, but just looking through the photographs and some of the thoughts in the book, it's likely that this was published sometime in the 1930s. And the name of today's episode, Planning Profitable Neighborhoods, actually comes from this writing. And so the interesting thing about this writing is that you have to keep in mind the historical context that, you know, in the 1930s, the U.S. is coming out of a recession. And one of the ways that the federal government recognizes could perhaps stabilize the economy is to become a major player in the mortgage market to leverage debt, get people in homes, and really look to build home ownership. And if you recall in the first episode, Zoning Rules, we talked about how the single family residence was reigning supreme in the country at this time and still does today. And so one of the things that became really important to the federal government when it became a player in the mortgage industry was that it needed to stabilize property values to protect its investment. And that's the same rationale behind, again, the home voter and his protection of his property value as being paramount to him. And it's true also for the federal government. And so one of the challenges that was taking place at the time was that there was no real way for the federal government to be able to protect an asset that it had, a mortgage, because there were not enough safeguards in place. Zoning was just, you know, coming to fruition or realization, and there were minimal protections that a house could not maybe be located next to a factory. And so as a result, the federal government became a key player in pushing forward these different philosophies and ideas as it relates to neighborhood design. And so in this book, what they do is they lay out these different principles of what good neighborhood design looks like from an economic perspective. And so what they do, if you can imagine, and again, I'm going to put these resources in the show notes, but if you can imagine, picture in your mind that there's an idea on each page, and then there's basically a graphic that shows what good neighborhood design looks like versus bad neighborhood design and how that looks from the perspective of the financial interest. And so one of the first ones that was really interesting was that good neighborhoods will actually discourage through traffic. And so in this graphic, what they're doing is they're actually advocating for dead end streets and for, you know, cul-de-sacs and for turnarounds, which then leads in to the next point that they have, which is that traffic should flow towards thoroughfares. And so really pushing out this idea of having this functional traffic system where essentially, you know, you have your local streets that go to collector streets that go to arterials. And that from their perspective, the grid is bad because you don't want to have major traffic in front of your house. And again, it's this idea of segmenting land uses that they're really talking about. But what it does is, and what this book does, is that it's actually putting those ideas into design criteria to guide developers, you know, to make these different decisions. And the reason that that's important is because the developers, they can't do much if a particular lot that they have can't be mortgaged. The majority of property owners in the 1930s, which is also true today, can't afford to buy their house in cash. And so they're really depending on the federal government, and the federal government saying, hey, look, these are good neighborhood design standards. They're likely going to follow them because they want to sell their lots and these homes. And so, you know, the next design criteria that they're looking at is that short blocks are not economical. And so again, encouraging these longer blocks to be built, never mind the fact that at the time, the city grid is very, from their perspective, uneconomical, but it's highly walkable. And so this is where we're starting to see design guidance push towards the automobile. And then the last one that also falls into that is then long blocks should have crosswalks, which again, if you have the short, uneconomical blocks, you really don't need to be concerned about crosswalks. And so the interesting thing about this writing, again, is that the federal government being a major player in mortgaging homes at the time, which for those of you that don't know, the FHA ends up becoming Fannie Mae, which is a major mortgage company in the U.S. still today. They end up mortgaging a bunch of homes. And so what they're asking developers to do is to build these different subdivisions, these suburbs, the first ring suburbs, in a particular way in order to protect the investment. And so what we'll discuss next is, you know, what are the challenges of building in a particular way to protect the investment and to build economically, as opposed to what good design looks like. So thus far, we've been talking about building profitable neighborhoods and some of the thought processes that were in place in the 1930s that the Federal Housing Administration put together and their bulletin, Building Profitable Neighborhoods. And now just want to discuss what the challenges are with focusing on building profitable neighborhoods as opposed to designing good neighborhoods. And so one of the things that we know is that because of some of the ideologies that were in place in the 1930s, they really took off, and a lot of suburban communities reflected a lot of the ideologies reflected in this, which when we read today what was considered good design guidance, we can see that it's actually the exact opposite of what we would call good neighborhood design today. And so as a result, we have a lot of neighborhoods that are built in between the 1930s to present day that reflect this thought process. And so we have a lot of neighborhoods now that aren't connected, that were built for single use, again, the single family residence. And it really creates a challenge because today, a lot of these inner ring suburbs, these older neighborhoods that maybe are 70, 80, 90 years old, are suffering from significant disinvestment. And because of the way that they're designed, they can't be repurposed into something else. So again, just want to reuse an example from before, which is that when there are neighborhoods that are part of a gridiron plan or a street grid, that the use of the properties can change over time because the size and shape of the lot, which affects the size and shape of the building, can be repurposed, it can be expanded, it can be repurposed in some other way than what its initial use is. The challenge with existing suburban development is that, truthfully, the only good use of that land is its current use. Suburbs and residential areas in general of our contemporary American suburbs really serve one purpose, and that is to be residential districts. And to think that over time they may change is not what reality shows. A lot of the older neighborhoods from the 1930s that were built specifically as suburbs in our cities still exist today as suburbs. And so they create significant challenges for governments that are looking to redevelop certain areas of the city where perhaps their infrastructure costs are significantly more than the tax revenue that they bring in. And it really does create a challenge. And because of the way that the neighborhood is designed and that it didn't follow a planned out street network, it inhibits its ability to be redeveloped. And so the last part of today's discussion builds on the initial writing that was done again by the Federal Housing Administration that looked at building profitable neighborhoods. And that is some of the ideas that were behind breaking away from the city grid. There was a book that was written in the early part of the 20th century called City Planning, great name of a book, by the author Charles Robinson. And it covers a lot of topics, but truthfully, the book is all about streets. And in it, he talks about some of the reasons for going away from the city grid towards more of a functional classification. Again, that's the arterial collector, local street connected network that we have today that wasn't really that common in the U.S. but was coming of age in Europe, and he was really advocating for it in the book. But essentially what he does is he lays out the arguments for why people at that time were advocating for the grid, and then what he calls the economic defects of standardization. And the standardization being that streets should be of uniform layout and uniform width. And so the reasons that he says that cities use the grid is that it's because it's easy. So the relative ease of laying out a city grid, which is true, it provides for future extensions of roadways in a logical way. Again, that's also a logical reason to use it. And then the last part was that it gives adequate light and space to areas of your city that may otherwise not have it. And so again, keeping in mind that at this time, this is predating zoning regulations in the U.S. And so because there weren't provisions specifically for light and air, that some cities were built in such a way that the roads were exceptionally narrow. There wasn't space in between buildings. And so streets were this opportunity to provide light and air that you otherwise couldn't have if they didn't build roads wide enough. And so these were the reasons that he identified as reasons for having standardization of roadways. But then what he says is that building this way, there's economic defects of standardization. And so some of the things that he brings up is that there's a significant cost to property owners if, for example, you're required to build a wider street than maybe is appropriate given the location of a particular development. One-size-fits-all approach means that sometimes roads are too wide and other times too narrow. And the last thing that I think really becomes the prevailing ideology moving forward in the U.S. is that streets should be designed to move people as quickly as possible. And so it became about ease. And the point of referencing both this and as well as the earlier writing that was done by the FHA is this to show how it's easy for us to look at some of this thinking and think, you know, that's crazy. We would never do that today. But there was good rationale at the time for it. And what's happened is that this ideology has been unchecked over time. And so as a result, we see these, you know, really worse off situations than were originally contemplated in the 30s, where, you know, they were advocating for ease of travel, but, you know, the ease of travel to them was being able to travel at, say, 25 miles per hour. They called highways, you know, roads that had two lanes in each direction. You know, today we're lucky to find a highway that has two lanes in each direction. And so the reason that this is really important for planners today is to recognize that one of the challenges that we're going to continue to have in some of our older neighborhoods is their inability to be redeveloped because of these design principles that were, you know, put in place in the 1900s, 1920s, 1930s, and created design challenges for those areas to be redeveloped into a higher and better use today. And then the other thing, and probably more pressing, is to use this knowledge to say that, okay, that was the thinking in the 1930s, but, you know, today we recognize that that isn't good design, and to go and look at your development code and say, you know, are those principles still existing in our codes today? Because more often than not, the answer to that is yes. You know, is your subdivision ordinance still looking at the functional classification of roadways for, you know, arterials, collectors, and local streets? And do they combine to create a grid system? In the Southwest, where I live, the grid system is a lot more common, and it's, you know, continued pattern throughout the city is much more common than perhaps in the Midwest or on the East Coast, where, you know, they were responding more to the terrain or to older trade routes. But, you know, does your development code ensure that today's neighborhoods produce well-designed neighborhoods and not profitable neighborhoods? And when we talk about profitable neighborhoods today, we're talking about profitable neighborhoods for the developer. And so allowing for subdivisions to be built a particular way that allows for cul-de-sacs, that allows for, you know, the curvilinear streets, allows for lot maximization, which is beneficial to the developer. But what it does is it pushes all that traffic out onto your arterials, which causes traffic congestion. And again, long-term, will create challenges for redevelopment. So thank you again today for joining me. It's been a really interesting discussion to look at some of the origins of our street network and how the building blocks, being the city block combined with zoning and the power of the Federal Housing Administration, have combined to create these design challenges in our neighborhoods. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you're enjoying the content, don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen and rate the podcast so we can continue to improve the content of each episode for our listeners. I'm Alex Huffman, and this is Planning Matters.